The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Coming up on the Mark Divine Show.
The thing with trauma is it's most activated when there's nothing you can do. Hence, torture, rape. My experience of talking to soldiers, they most often get traumatized in two situations. Not when they're running around fighting. It's when they're being shelled and they can't do anything. Or when they're watching a friend bleed out. Because again, there's nothing they can do.
This is Mark Divine Show, and I'm your host, Mark Divine. Thanks for joining me today on the Mark Divine Show. I love to explore what it means to be fearless by speaking to some of the world's most interesting, fearless, compassionate, and resilient leaders, folks from all walks of life, stoic philosophers, motivational scientists, nutritional experts, and trauma peace crusaders like my guest today, Mr. Embodiment Mark Walls. Mark is the author of Embodiment, Working with the Body in Training and Coaching, and also Embodied Meditation. He's the host of the Embodiment podcast and runs a conference called the Embodiment Conference. Obviously, really into embodiment. He's also founder of the Embodiment Facilitator Course, has trained over 2,000 coaches in 40 countries. He's recently in Ukraine working to help relieve trauma over there through a charity called saneukraine.org. Amazing. So he's worked in war zone. He's an entertainer. He's entertained over 50,000 kids. He's taught at Moscow State University. He's lived with a circus in Ethiopia, taught celebrities, and even kissed a princess. He's also an Aikido black belt and has 25 years of experience with other martial arts, yoga, bodywork, conscious dance, and meditation. Incredible. Mark, thank you so much for joining me on the Mark Divine Show. Before I get into the show, I wanted you to know that I'm opening up slots for our Unbeatable Coach Certification and our Unbeatable Team for 2024. The Unbeatable Team is an amazing year of transformational training. It's where I direct my full attention and time in coaching and training. I don't do it anywhere else. It's here in the Unbeatable Team that I can give my full attention to help those deeply committed to transforming to become uncommon in a world that you know is rapidly collapsing into fear, moral relativism, and mediocrity. We meet virtually every month as a team, come together four times during the year for 3 days of powerful in-person training and practice, and I'm here to help you break through any barriers and to crush all of your goals for 2024. So if you're ready to go deep with me and willing to do the work, I can guarantee amazing strides will be made. Go to unbeatableteam.com and unbeatablecoaching.com to learn more about these unbeatable events. Now, back to the show. Mark Walsh, thanks so much for joining me on the Mark Divine Show. How are you today, sir?
Pretty good. Enjoying relaxing in Portugal after some intense work. So nice to see you again, Mark.
Yeah, you mentioned you were over in Ukraine. Tell us about that. You're doing some training over there. How are the folks over in that area?
Yeah, I mean, the last I saw the team was a week ago in Krakow. The team called Save Ukraine. It's a charity I started last year in Ukraine. They do psychological trauma training. And this time, we decided to do the training in Poland. Constantly rushing to the bomb shelter is a little bit distracting for any training.
I bet.
So much nicer to do it in scenic tourist Krakow, which is more relaxing than the time before in Ukraine. So yeah, nice to see the team.
What's the general attitude over there right now? How are people getting by? Are they trying to normalize things or just give us a description of what it's like?
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been 18 months since the invasion. Obviously, there's all kinds of people in all kinds of places. But yeah, in a way, it's the new normal. And people sometimes are just exhausted from the constant fight or flight, just being in that environment. Obviously, a lot of people have lost loved ones. Pretty much everyone I know there knows someone who's died or, you know, who's in immediate danger. Though it's different in different cities, different places. Same working with refugees from there. You know, some refugees kind of drove in their BMWs to Germany on the first day of the war. Some kind of got their houses bombed and had to walk to the border, you know, so it's very people in very different situations.
And are they hungry for this type of work that you're offering them, the embodied healing?
Yeah, so my work is an embodiment teacher and trauma is one of the aspects of that. The Ukrainians very much see trauma healing, trauma education as something Western, as something intelligent and as something kind and most of all non-Russian. So for them, it's very positive framing for them.
Yeah.
They're like, well, this is something, you know, the West does. It's something Russia doesn't do. Therefore, we want to be aligned with the West. So therefore, this is a good thing. And I think this is, in a way, the world's first trauma-informed war, in that normally what happens is there's a war, everyone gets traumatized, everyone denies there's any trauma. And 20 or 30 years later, you know, with the NAM vets or whatever it is, the Gulf War vets, then people go, oh, hang on, we need to deal with this. But only after the alcoholism, domestic violence, you know, suicides. And in this case, it's really there from the beginning and it has a very positive framing. So obviously an ideal world would be no war, but a pretty good world would be one where people are at least informed of the consequences and they're able to reach out for help when they need it.
And who is the target for your work over there? I mean, you're actually working with military guys who are coming back from the front, or just general civilians who are traumatized from the next air raid siren?
Yeah, I mean, the team that I started it, but it's now run by local women and they do the training themselves now. You know, I'm a supervisor, I'm an advisor, friend of the project now. They've trained hundreds of thousands of people. For example, they've trained all the doctors and all the teachers and all the nurses in Lviv, which is one of the major cities and one of the big refugee cities. They go to military bases regularly. They train children. They train anyone who's interested in trauma, which is pretty much everyone in Ukraine. And, you know, just incredible young women who will stand in front of 200 soldiers and be able to get across to them, which is amazing. So, you know, I'm very proud of them.
Oh, that's incredible work. Wow. Thank you for doing that. That's cool. It's amazing how much hunger there is for this. And you wouldn't think that in a war-torn area that folks would be even have the space to think, oh, I'm going to go get trained as a trauma therapist or body worker or whatever. I'm working with these guys out of the group called the Conscious Coalition, and we're working in Sudan, helping out, you know, with first responders and others, you know, teaching them resiliency skills and coping mechanisms and, you know, that type of stuff. So it's not too dissimilar.
Yeah, I think they see the necessity of it.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's acute. It's right there. I mean, they're dealing with it right now. But you know, it's not like in the United States or I guess any country, COVID had a similar traumatizing effect. And so, you know, if you think, oh, that's just for a war-torn area now, I mean, like people are being traumatized daily with, you know, economic warfare and, you know, the effects of the lockdowns from COVID, which are still, you know, people are still digging out of that mess. So everyone can benefit. What exactly are you doing over there? I mean, what are you teaching the teachers and what specifically tools or skills are you bringing to them?
Yeah, so mostly what the team are teaching is trauma education. Can't train therapists quickly, but you can train trauma educators very quickly. And just knowing what trauma is very helpful. Being able to signpost people to resources, being able to say, hey, these are the symptoms of trauma. This is what you might look out for. I remember I actually married a Ukrainian, and this was some years ago. And just before my wedding, I was asked, my wife said, hey, come, my then fiance said, hey, can you, just before the wedding, can you come and talk to my hairdresser? Because he's been drafted into what was the first part of the Ukraine war. And I said, yeah, sure. So turned up and there, and he's brought, you know, 30 of his friends. They're all traumatized. They've all had difficult experiences. Some of them were captured, prisoners of war. And I thought, God, I've got an hour because then I have to go pick up the rings, you know, like on a schedule there. And I thought, you know what? In an hour, what can I do? So I just said, look, this is my experience of working in various areas of conflict. This is my experience of what trauma can look like. You know, if you find yourself doing the following things, you're not crazy, but you might need help. And, you know, I talked through some of the symptoms of sort of sleeplessness or anger. You know, one of the guys is like, hey, why do I hit my kids now? I didn't used to hit my kids. Why do I get angry so easily? Someone else is like, hey, I can't make love to my wife. What's going on? I, you know, talk about how trauma can lead to dysfunction in various ways. Dietary issues, alcohol issues, which can be common, particularly amongst, you know, ex-service personnel. And you can see the soldiers kind of nodding, going, okay, this guy gets it. And just from my demeanor, my embodiment, they could see like, okay, this guy is not, you know, Northern Californian therapist who doesn't understand their world.
And you're married to a Ukrainian.
Yeah, that also helps. It gives me a way in. And I just said, okay, and here are the services locally you can go to. And, you know, here's a woman from the army that you might want to talk to because it would come from a guy and they were comfortable with that. Then, you know, at the end of it, they were like hugging me and some were crying and saying, oh, thank you. I thought I was going mad. Even just giving people the basics of what trauma is helpful. And then there's something called trauma first aid, which is what one might do in the immediate aftermath of an overwhelming experience. That would mean one would be more likely to just have acute trauma rather than chronic trauma. Because most people have something traumatic happen in their life, particularly somewhere like Ukraine, but everywhere really. There's, I think, 80% prevalence of traumatic incidents if you live in the UK, let alone if you live in Ukraine. So what do we do after, in the immediate aftermath of that, so that it's less likely to get, you know, that fight or flight's less likely to get stuck in our system and become a more permanent problem? And there's a whole series of techniques called trauma first aid. So for example, some of the team were at the railway stations talking to refugees or advising soldiers on things they can do with each other and, you know, various techniques that can be used.
That sounds very important, right? If you self-assess that you've been in a traumatic situation, you know, you observe something, like what's the number one thing that could be done either for self-care or for, you know, rendering aid?
Well, there's a few. I mean, move your body. You know, I was just advising some Israeli friends, for example. I'm like, hey, in their case, I was saying, don't watch the news 24/7. That's one. Talk to Israeli friends, talk to Ukrainian friends, like, hey.
Like, I find that traumatizing here in the United States.
Right, yeah. I mean, any news, most of which is lies, right? It's, I think we probably agree on the state of the news is perhaps not helpful. But, you know, if you're seeing violations and awful things happening, and of course, you know, it's good to be informed. But most of the Ukrainians, for example, have got alerts set up on their phones, which if there's a bomb coming, immediately start beeping and, you know, there's apps for it. So they don't need to be watching the news all day long. So things like limiting news exposure, moving the body after traumatic incidents, like even something as simple as, you know, you're in a car accident and, you know, the police might come and put a blanket around you and tell you to sit still. And maybe your friend gives you a whiskey. And in fact, it might be better to just, you know, walk up and down a bit, you know, or go shake it off, do some exercise, the gym, that can be very helpful. Social support. So reaching out for social support, particularly if you have access to people who aren't in that fight or flight or freeze mode. So, you know, I'm on the phone to some of my friends in the Middle East right now, and I'm able to, you know, just be a little bit of a voice of sanity and a nervous system that isn't right in the middle of it all. So the social support aspect's really critical too. And then there's other techniques. There's things like something called TRE. There's tapping techniques. There's various sort of discharge techniques for that kind of energy in the body that gets stored.
What exactly is happening? You know, if a traumatic incident happens, obviously I get triggered in a fight or flight. Is it that I'm not allowing that to release and to activate the opposite, you know, the rest and digest? And so then it just, what, it gets trapped in the body? Or what's happening? What's the mechanism?
Yeah, there's different theories of this. And some people can go into the neuroscience, for example, much more intelligently than I can. I think there's a few ways to look at it. A pretty good way, sort of basic way of I'll explain it to people is, you know, we all have that fight or flight, but there's two things that can happen there. One is it can get kind of more stuck in the body, is sometimes how people describe it. So instead of being agitated and then calming down, you know, if I look at my pulse now, I've got a pulse of like 80, which is, you know, pretty appropriate. You know, I'm doing an interview, I'm active, but I'm not stressed. That's like I've come down from some stress I had this morning. You know, stress comes and goes, traumatic stress stays. And there's, you know, various reasons for that, some of which is what we do, some of which seems very random, some of which is people's health and well-being. The different risk factors that you could analyze out there as to why someone might get more trauma and someone else just gets distressed and then comes down. And another way of thinking about it is people go from fight or flight into overwhelming stress and they go more into a freeze response, which is a different neurology. You know, for example, people have studied this. The polyvagal guys have theories on the different strands of the vagus nerve, for example, involved in that. And that freeze response getting stuck in the system can look like many things, but for example, it could look like digestive issues, different health issues. You'll see in Eastern Europe, you'll see a lot of reduced affect. So you'll see the sort of, you've probably seen, you know, hot Russian or Ukrainian girls walking around with the sort of lack of smile. They're not really kind of engaged. You know, that's the soldier with the 1,000-yard stare. His eyes are chronically tight. They might have chronic tightness in the body. And again, all the health issues associated with that. And unfortunately, part of that can be a reduction in kind of social engagement and empathy, which is why you do get these cycles of hurt people hurting people. You do get these cycles of trauma producing numbness, which can reduce empathy. Because while it's in many ways an understandable response to overwhelming threat to shut down, unfortunately, that shuts down the systems we need for parenting and marriage and just general social function. So some of those systems are dysfunctional. There are other ways of looking at it. Another would be like, it's almost like a memory disorder. So there's a way in which the traumatic memory doesn't get stored as a normal long-term memory. So there's a sort of a nowness. So it's a dangerous past living in the present. And I've had this for myself from various countries and to various levels. And people might know about dissociative flashbacks, which is the more extreme level. But, you know, you've probably got buddies who just constantly talk about their experiences in Afghan or in Iraq or whatever, because they're still living there in a way. And like, I remember my granddad, till the day he died, was talking about World War II as if it was yesterday. it clearly hadn't totally got into his kind of long-term memory. And sometimes it's subtle. I remember one time I was in the gym working out, and I had some kind of psoas release from a deep squat, which is a muscle associated with traumatic memory. And I just kind of like felt I was in Afghanistan for about a week. It was just like a subtle, almost like a smell or a subtle feeling that was just there. Yeah, it was a weird background feeling. It just made me a lot more on edge than I normally would be in my hometown.
Interesting. I'm also curious how micro-traumatic brain injuries could play a role, you know, especially with the military guys who are on the front line. As a SEAL, you know, we have a lot of our SEAL team guys who are like, seem perfectly normal, and all of a sudden they just go boom, right? They just lose it. And it's happened in, you know, increasing numbers over the last few years. And you talked about the psychological trauma, but also there's physical trauma, like you see with the football players and soccer players and hockey players. And for, you know, military people, it's the, you know, even going to the range and shooting. If you're not using the protective ear protection and, you know, that you're getting that kind of ricochet and your brain is just bouncing around in your head. And so I imagine that, you know, as we, you know, research these things a little more, you're going to find out that is a big factor as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. So in World War One, when they first identified trauma, they identified it as shell shock because they thought it was from the physical shock of the shells. And then later on, they realized like, hey, no, this is psychological. And, you know, World War II, they called it combat fatigue. You know, PTSD was a Vietnam era terminology. When they realized that soldiers had a lot in common with people who had been abused by a spouse, they realized there was something similar. But what's interesting is in recent years, they've gone, oh, actually, the physical shock is potentially involved as well. So the World War One theory was not totally wrong, is what they found.
Right. It's both and.
I'm not an expert on that, but it looks like there's some research to say that there's, you know, vulnerabilities at least. And unfortunately, the Ukraine front lines are very reminiscent of World War One. And Bakhmut and places like that, they're really horrific. And actually, we almost had to go back to the drawing board because I talked to a lot of the sort of American and British trauma experts, and they didn't really know how to deal with that kind of stuff. You know, that kind of war hasn't been involved in for a while with massive loss of life, you know, guys losing their entire platoon kind of thing. And also just a constant feeling of powerlessness. I was talking to one British volunteer. And he said, you know, being in a trench and trying to pull his helmet down over him as if he was like a turtle. The thing with trauma is it's most activated when there's nothing you can do. Hence, torture, rape. My experience of talking to soldiers, they most often get traumatized in two situations. Not when they're running around fighting. It's when they're being shelled and they can't do anything. Or when they're watching a friend bleed out. Because again, there's nothing they can do. They're the two situations where people, soldiers who normally feel quite empowered, actually feel disempowered. And there's a lot of that, unfortunately, in Ukraine, the sort of just, you know, because if you're in your trench and if a shell hits you, there's nothing you can do. You know, if that's a direct hit, that's it. So, and you know that. You can take precautions. But and Ukraine will be suffering, and Russia too, the impacts of trauma from this war for generations. And we're already talking with the team about how to reintegrate soldiers, for example, because the reintegration issues are a huge, huge aspect for soldiers.
Wow.
Limb loss is another one that's huge there. So we had to kind of look at a lot of work on grief and look at kind of, you know, the grief of limb loss and how that is. It's been another big one.
Yeah. It's mind-boggling, you know, that here we are in the 2023 and I'm still fighting like barbarians at the gate. It's crazy.
Sometimes I have these moments where I'm with the team and they're just, you know, young women doing their best kind of thing. You know, I basically went to the local university and said, right, I need all your psychology students to train. I knew all the few therapists that existed, and there's some great ones like EMDR therapists I know who we were working with. They were like, you know, they're all super busy. And, you know, these young women, sometimes I want to say to them, like, look, we shouldn't have to do this. This is ridiculous, you know, in 2023 that we have to do this. And we do. So let's get on with it. But there's sometimes it's just a moment of crying or pulling my hair out and just saying, really? Seriously?
Exactly. The worst of humanity in our current structure ascends to the highest power structures and have control over the most devastating weapons. Like, how do we get here? Well, it can only be answered probably spiritually. I think the trauma work is so important, but I also know that, you know, it's not what you really do also. Like embodiment work and the work you do in training coaches, you know, it can be used to heal from some extreme trauma, but it can also be used to, you know, evolve your consciousness, so to speak, right? To become more whole, more of a complete human being, let's just say. So let's talk about that side of your work. Like, what does that look like? And what does embodiment even mean to you? And Yeah, what does it mean? Because like we are a body and the body is the mind. And so how can we embody, how can we be more of what we already are?
I mean, to make the link, most trauma therapies involve the body because trauma is that cutting of the link between body and mind. There's a disembodiment, numbing.
Disembodiment, right.
Yeah. However, the average person isn't particularly embodied anyway because we live in a sort of hypercognitive cerebral culture where the body is reduced to, as someone said, a brain taxi. You know, most people aren't physical. They're not moving. You know, I grew up working on farms. You're in your body a little bit more just from the elements and the labor, you know. If you're running around as a seal, you're probably a bit more in your body. But it's most people are, you know, on their phones, on a computer. Add a little bit of trauma to that, maybe we're numbed out. And there's a cost to that numbing. You know, our body isn't just a piece of meat. The body is a key part of who we are. It's a gateway to the soul, if you want to be poetic. You know, I ask people, like, if I'm in a corporation, I'll say, where do you have your best ideas? And I say, let me guess. Listeners can play this game, you know. I'll say, you don't have them sitting at the computer. You have them when you're walking in nature. You might have them in the shower, maybe on the toilet.
Einstein, all of his best ideas came while he was walking, sometimes in his underwear.
Usually it's you're moving, you're in nature, because there's a degree of what we can call eco-regulation to the body. You're either in good company, like dancing or making love, there's co-regulation. But nearly always you're relaxing, like in the shower, on the toilet, in your body. Because your mind just works better when you're in those situations. It doesn't work well when you're stressed out at a computer in traffic or whatever. So the idea of embodiment is very practical in that it's helping people think better. It's helping people communicate better. You know, so much of our communication is embodied. It makes me laugh. I'm in a business and there's some guy who's getting paid $100,000 a year and he's, you know, done an MBA from Oxford or Harvard or something. And he's just a head on a stick. And he's like, you know,
exactly.
Hello, welcome to my company. I'm the inspiring CEO. And I'm like, okay, man, we need to get you at least moving. Let's give him some embodied practice. Just super stressed out. Like everybody I work with, God love them. They don't have to be in a war. They're just stressed. I mean, I remember when I was in my first boardroom doing corporate stuff and I'd already done NGO work, nonprofit sector work in war zones. And I just remember thinking, God, this is the same embodiment. This is the same, you know, this from your work,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like people are so stressed that they need some stress management tools and you can't really think your way out of that. It's like, you know, if two guys are about to have a fight, you can't just reason with them. Yeah, excuse me, gentlemen, I think this is an unwise move. You know, this is not going to work. So you have to work directly with the body. If you're interested in working with people, the body is the quickest, most effective access point. And if you want to create lasting change, you have to work with the body because otherwise the body will just undermine all your nice theories and books or whatever.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here from the Mark Divine Show to hear a short message from one of our partners. After 2 years of relentless development, I'm super stoked to unveil Seal Fit Electro Greens. This isn't any greens powder. It's a USDA organic superfood enriched with more than 25 organic vegetables and fruits and electrolytes added. It's perfect for those who demand the most from their bodies and their minds and are often on the go. My journey with the Navy SEALs taught me the power of leadership and resilience built on a foundation of optimal health. That's why I founded SEALFIT, not just for elite athletes or special ops candidates, but for anyone who's committed to conquering their physical and mental limits. This product is designed to support you in that journey. I recommend starting your day with a scoop of Electro Greens and 8 ounces of cold water to get your day going with the health and nutrition you need to optimally perform. Currently, the product is only available on Amazon. Search for Seal Fit Electro Greens on Amazon. Use the code SEALGREENS25, that's SEALGREENS, plural, 25 at checkout. Get 25% off your order. You're going to love this product. Hoo-yah! Seal Fit Electro Greens. You know, I grew up wearing jeans. I love jeans, but I got to tell you, they've never been super comfortable until I found Doer. I'm super stoked to have found this pair of jeans. They are amazing. Not only do they look incredible, but they're incredibly comfortable. I've been wearing these things for a couple months. I wear them out to dinner. I wear them traveling. I wear them just cruising around. I can even wear them working out. They make this stretch performance denim with tons of lifestyle apparel for both men and women. Their timeless styles are unlike traditional denim. They're made from natural fibers, have high stretch, breathability, and moisture absorption. They've got temperature regulation and antimicrobial properties, so they feel
fresh and cool and dry. I love the fit for these things. I love the feel. And I love the sustainability of Dewar. They use 85% plant-based materials for natural softness and comfort. Upgrade your jean wardrobe with a pair of Dewar jeans today. You can check out their flagship store in LA or Denver, or shop online at shopdewar.com/divine. That's shop, shopdewar.com for an awesome deal of 20% off on your order. Again, shopdewar.com/divine. Get 20% off now for these amazing jeans.
And now back to the show. Yeah, I recently developed a program and I ran it once, and it was a little too early for me to kind of put it out as a product, but I called it the Exponential Mindset. And I talked about developing the five minds. And the first mind is the body mind. So the point you just made is spot on. Like, if the body is in hyperarousal, if the body is out of shape, overweight, out of homeostasis in any way, then the brain is as well. And so your cognitive functions are going to be impaired.
There's the foundational level of just kind of health, but there's also the foundations of our emotional intelligence. Like, where is empathy? It's in the body. You know, are we tuned into our body to pick up on our intuition or the quality of rapport that we're in with someone? I mean, even as I said, like, our cognition is based on that. The leader someone is embodied. And, you know, by that, I don't mean, are they tall or are they skinny? That's not so much about physical fitness, though that's a good base. It's something else. It's, again, do they have the qualities of a leader? I learned some of that through martial arts, for example, and it's not taught academically. You can read a lot of good books and a lot of theories, but, you know, does someone have it in their spine? Does someone have it in their muscle, their bones, their sinew? That's what it really comes down to.
That's the difference between knowledge and knowing. Using your martial arts example, you know, that's why you start out as a white belt, you know, and you work from ninth Q down to first Q, and, you know, like going downhill, you're just packing knowledge in and you're starting to learn some basic movements. But you don't really start knowing until you're well into your first, second, third degree black belt, right? Because you're embodying the movements. You're getting out of your head and just spontaneously acting, right? Shibumi, effortless perfection starts to flow, usually, you know, with long period of practice. But I think, you know, in the West, we're so infatuated with knowledge and just packing more knowledge in, and conceptual knowledge, you know, disembodied or disconnected from the knowingness of the body, is not that useful in the long run. It's good for a career as an academic, but not much else.
Right. We've taken that academic model of knowing about things, and that's very different than knowing something, let alone being something. We were talking about Portugal earlier, you know, like, I could tell you about Portugal and you would know a bit more about Portugal, but that's different from, I don't know, the smell here, not what it is to hang out in a Portuguese bar and eat a pastel de nata. There's a quality here. I mean, all leadership skills are not academic knowledge. I mean, you can explain emotional intelligence very quickly, but how do you build it? And for me, that level of being will either support or undermine anything we know. And it's almost like our culture's obsessed. It misunderstands the verb to know and has become obsessed with knowing about things rather than knowing to do things or knowing to be things. We even, you know, don't respect the other kinds of knowing so much. You say, oh, he's just a tradesman. I'm like, okay, this is the guy who fixes your electricity or your plumbing. You know, yeah, this is someone who really knows his art. So for me, like, if you're going to look at leadership seriously, or I work with a lot of coaches, for example, I help coaches, and it's like, again, it's not just cognitive.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In fact, our work, we're calling it vertical leadership development, because, you know, it's probably a little misleading. It's inclusive embodiment, but it's a type of development that transcends who you were and gives you a new sense of self, self-concept that is, like I said, inclusive embodiment, new context, world-centric in your perspective, open-hearted, compassionate, caring. And those are all aspects of beingness that, you just like you said, you can't learn from a book. It has to kind of emerge within you. And yet we know that there's certain practices and tools and methods to find that emergence or to activate that emergence. And I think that's what somatic work and embodiment practice is so valuable. Most people approach it in different ways. And I'm curious, because I'm a lifetime martial artist and a yogi myself. Movement has always been really, really important. And you mentioned movement, right, to release immediate acute trauma. How central is a somatic type practice like a martial art or yoga or dance or just, you know, being in nature to embodiment?
Yeah, I mean, all my students have a meditation practice and a movement practice. And what that movement practice is, first of all, I say, look, something's better than nothing. Just moving your body is great. Moving your body with awareness, like yoga, conscious dance, martial arts, that's even better than just going to the gym, which is still better than nothing. And then if we're going to be even more selective, we could say, okay, what qualities do you want to build? So for example, first time I walked into an Aikido dojo, I was 18-year-old alcoholic from a, you know, family of alcoholics. Something in me saw the discipline, the spine, the Japanese-ness, you know, the whole piece culturally and embodiment-wise of Aikido, and really spoke to my heart. And I was like, wow, this is going to save my life. And it did, right? And for many years, Aikido was practiced, if not daily, several times a week. I was a live-in Aikido student. And then after a while, I had, you know, enough of that sort of warrior archetype, but kind of integrated that. And we were doing the Ukraine project. My driver was an Aikido friend called Pietra, Polish Pete, who I was a live-in Aikido student with. And we were doing that project and we were saying, you know, Mr. Smith, who was our teacher, Cheyenne Smith in England, we said, look, he taught us the embodiment to do this, to deliver medical supplies and do trauma work in a war zone. So it's like that way of being has, you know, been with me now 25 years. But there was a point where actually I realized that I was getting diminishing returns from doing Aikido. And that's when I started, I took up tango dance. I was like, okay, let's time for music and women's perfume and fabulous shoes and, you know, play. And it's like, you're not going to find that in a Japanese martial art. You know what I mean? Argentine women in high heels, you know? Yeah,
variety is good. I love it.
Yeah, build the range. So, you know, what you'll tend to find in martial artists or the same yogis, conscious dancers, is they'll get very, very good at one thing, and then maybe they could actually branch out a little bit.
Yeah.
So if someone's a beginner, I'm just like, do any embodied practice. If someone's a bit more advanced, I'd say, okay, let's talk about what you're doing. We send the salsa dancer to kickboxing or whatever, the jiu-jitsu guides, you know, whatever. You know, I wrote a whole book about this, and it's become one of my specialisms as a coach, is helping people design their own embodied practice.
You know, I'm a lifetime martial artist, but I kind of like, for the past 3 or 4 or 5 years, you know, more I had a similar experience to you. The more I trained, the more I felt like I was intuitively that I was just like reinforcing something that didn't need to be reinforced anymore, right? And so I was like, what is that? I got into the martial arts to develop my warrior archetype, right? And to really understand what it meant to take a life and what it meant to not take a life. You know, the martial art is a beautiful practice if you're doing it with the right intentions, right? If you're doing it to be the badass and to go out and play whack-a-mole, that's not the right intention. But when I got into yoga and I started practicing yoga, and you know, one of the primary principles there is ahimsa, which is peace, which is not, it's not like conceptual. It begins to emerge in you through that practice. So I was beginning to experience peace, and it was in conflict with, and even my last art is Aikido, even they call it the art of peace. It still was born in war, and it's a violent program. So I finally said, you know what? I need to stop doing martial arts now. I think I've learned enough. And so I continue my yoga practice, but to your point, really exploring other embodiment practices. And so dance is one of them. I think that's really cool. More time in nature, back to some of my old like seal fit roots, rucking with weight and, you know what I mean, in the ocean swimming. So it's been pretty cool.
Yeah, it sounds like you intuitively got to that, and credit to you, because a lot of people get very invested in what they do. It becomes part of their persona and identity.
For sure.
And being a beginner again is never real. I remember being in my first, you know, I went to conscious dance, which is like crazy hippie dancing, and the martial artist in me was like, where am I? What the hell am I doing? You know, this is a confrontation. And then now I love it. Now I love it. Contact improv and conscious dance and all these fun hippie things. I love it.
I have this weird kind of discord, but I understand it now with my martial arts practice. I never was with a particular teacher or studio long enough to really move beyond, you know, a shodan. So I've got like four shodans. And so I always thought that was a kind of a problem, or, you know, it was an unfortunate circumstance, because there, you know, there's a benefit for staying in, you know, and you get your four, all my peers back at Sato Karate with Nakamura in New York are all 6th, 7th dons. But what was nice about that is I had to be a white belt 4 different times and start over. And now, of course, I had a lot of skills and, you know, I progressed pretty quickly, but I always had to empty my cup every time I, you know, moved somewhere or, you know, had to change my, I had 2 studios, you know, shut down because the teachers couldn't run them. It's interesting, but it taught me to empty my cup and to always think like a white belt. there's an entrapment that can happen, just like in any type of hierarchical structure, when you're like, oh, I'm the sixth or I'm the seventh, you know, and you start to get the spiritual egoism or this, you know what I mean?
I remember going, you know, as a pretty competent Aikido black belt, going into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu dojo for the first time. Because I was like, yeah, you know, Aikido's got some holes and there's some things I want to learn. And, you know, it's not very realistic in these ways. And my friend Rockcast, actually, he did a whole YouTube channel about this journey from being an, he's a Lithuanian guy, from being an Aikido black belt to becoming an MMA guy. It's a humbling.
I bet.
You know, I remember being choked out maybe 20 times at my first night on the mat. And I had to really, like 2 days later to go back to class, I had to really like gear myself up, you know, and this. Yeah. And then it's humbling that. And, you know, like I know parkour guys who can jump across buildings fearlessly, but they can't talk to a pretty woman, you know? It's like, you got to be able to transfer the skills or else, so who cares if you can do a wrist lock or jump across a building or who cares, you know? Like, can you transfer it into your life is what I'm most interested in now.
Right. If someone comes to you and after listening to this podcast and they say, hey, Mark, I'm ready. How do you assess or help them understand kind of what kind of embodiment practice would be right for them?
Yeah, I mean, people might turn up as a coach and they just want to learn a few coaching tools. And, you know, I can show them a few basic tools to work with the body, practical things like centering, which will be helpful as a coach. If they come to me as a yoga teacher or a dance teacher, that's very different, right? If they come to me as a soldier, that's very different. So it's really who's the person, you know, what's their level of experience with the body. With business guys, it's like, you have a body. This is, you know, sort of, you know, 101, and maybe let's do some stress management. You know, let's do some stuff on charisma and leadership, because that might be helpful for you. You know, that's very different than someone in Ukraine or someone who's already a coach with a 10-year yoga practice, for example. I think increasingly now I get students who are already meditating. What do you found, Mark? But to me, loads more people are meditating than 25 years ago when I started this stuff, right?
Oh, for sure.
So that's great.
But I find they're struggling with it.
Yeah, often they've got an app, maybe a light practice. They might not have done retreats. You know, they're not necessarily... Meditation was never really meant to be removed from the whole Buddhist structure of ethics and wisdom and different traditions. But, it, you know, if people have a basic meditation practice, that's helpful. And, you know, often people have done a bit of yoga or a bit of martial arts now. I mean, my life's got a lot easier. Like, I remember going in companies 20 years ago, people just going, what? You know, mindful what? You know, and now they're like, the HR manager's like, oh yeah, I do yoga and I've got a mindfulness app. And it might not be you, but my life's got a lot easier.
That's pretty funny. You use the term embodied meditation in your book title. Is that a specific practice?
There's a few practices in that particular book. And I think the word mindfulness is a translation of a Pali word. And it's a very sort of 19th century British aristocratic translation that misses a lot of stuff. So unfortunately, if you take sort of Western cognitive people, translate the word in a very cognitive way, and they extract it from a kind of cultural tradition, you will get a very cognitive practice. So a lot of meditation, I think, is embodied, even if they don't use the word. You know, it's a nice word, but sometimes people need to come back to meditating as a body, with a body, not just on a body. Sometimes I feel like a lot of modern meditation is, it's like how you would stare at a parking ticket, you know? It's just like looking at your body from afar with disgust. And that's probably not the best approach.
No, I agree with that. One of my yoga teachers, I did like a 500-hour training with him, said that yoga was actually depth psychology. And what he meant by that is the way it was taught in the sutras and the Vedic tradition was that it was a whole mind-body intuitive spiritual practice. And so Zen is just the dharana, the concentration part of yoga. And mindfulness was just the, you know, kind of like the witnessing cognitive metacognition component, like learn how to separate from your thoughts and just sit there with them in non-attachment. And they were just two techniques that were kind of seized upon and then turned into entire systems. And so they've led to, you know, incomplete results. And I think that was very insightful for me.
Nice. And, you know, yoga can be done as a sort of narcissism practice. It can be done as exercise. It can be done as deep body therapy, which really confronts the patterns. You know, we have an embodied system. We teach yoga people where it's really, you know, we have poses that explore boundaries and generosity and eroticism and all, you know, different aspects of being human that they can integrate into their yoga. You know, everything has a commercial aspect these days. But then there's also, you know, so many... Yeah, like you, I have a podcast, and I feel so lucky that I get to talk to just a lot of very cool practitioners people doing, you know, deep stuff around the world. And we're in a pretty unique point in human history, even if it's crazy and the world's run by psychopaths. We're also in a point of human history where people can download podcasts and get information they would have had to travel to Tibet for. You know, it's uniquely horrible in some ways. Even the fact that we find it astounding that there's still war, that's progress. That's an improvement. The fact that we are disgusted by it and don't just think it's normal and okay. And that we have access to so many of these wisdom traditions.
My sense is that everything's always in balance, right? So if there's an awful lot of awfulness, then there's an awful lot of goodness in the world to balance that out. So you have two books, and then the other is Embodied Meditation.
Three. So the first one is just called Embodiment for Complete Beginners. You can read that on the toilet. It's very accessible. Second one is more for like professional facilitators and coaches. That's, you know, published by Open University Press. And the third one's just a little book on meditation. There's three books I have out, just because, you know, you've got to have a book out, right, Mark? It's the thing.
You've got to have a book out, yeah. And you've got the Embodiment Podcast. That's what I mean. You're doing so much great work. How can folks find you? How do you like to engage with people? Is it email, social media?
Yeah, books and podcasts, if they're like that. If people want to ask me a question, the best is actually through my Instagram. I don't really email, but so if you put Mark Walsh into Instagram or Mark Walsh Embodiment, you'll find me there. That's for questions. If they're short, I will always get back to people personally. And the main website is embodimentunlimited.com. And there's a load of free stuff there. So my first book, there's a free PDF of that, for example. If people, you know, don't want to go to Amazon, they can download that there. Embodimentunlimited.com, loads of free resources there.
What's next for you, Mark? You're going to go back to Ukraine or off to some other adventure?
I'm going to take a rest. I'm going to eat seafood on the beach for a week in Portugal.
And dance.
Because maybe dance with the hippies in the woods if I can. yeah, I need a rest, man. Like, I feel like there has to be a flow between giving and receiving. And nature's always been a great healer for me personally. I have a therapist, but often I'd rather be swimming in the sea than talking to him, frankly. So
fair enough. Me too.
That's my therapeutic, slightly pagan plan for letting go of the trauma of the world is getting off the internet and swimming in the sea in Portugal.
That sounds amazing. Well, enjoy. You deserve it. And thank you for your work. Thank you for your time today, sir.
Oh, you too, Marco. I think you're a kindred spirit, and I love the stuff you're putting out. So it's real, real pleasure.
Thank you very much. Hoo-yah. Well, that was a fascinating episode. I'm so inspired by Mark's work in Ukraine. It's amazing. So it's so important. And my heart goes out to all those folks who are traumatized there and in Israel and elsewhere. So thank you, Mark, for joining us today on the Mark Divine Show. Show notes will be up on our website at markdivine.com. The video will be on our YouTube channel. You can reach out to me on social media at Twitter X at Mark Divine and on Instagram or Facebook at Real Mark Divine or on my LinkedIn profile. If you're not receiving Divine Inspiration, my weekly newsletter, you might consider joining the email list. So go to markdivine.com to subscribe. I send it out every Tuesday morning. It's got show notes for the week's podcast, my blog, a book I'm reading, other cool things, and a practice of the week. And I think you might enjoy it. So sign up and share. And thanks for doing that. Shout out to my incredible team, Catherine Divine, Jason Sanderson, and Jeff Haskell, who helped produce the podcast and Divine Inspiration and bring guests like Mark to you every week. Ratings and reviews are very helpful, so if you haven't done so, please consider doing that wherever you listen. It helps keep us at the top of the rankings and to stay relevant and helps other people find it. So thank you very much again for your support. Thanks for being part of the Mark Divine Show. Please share it with your friends if you find it interesting and helpful. Thanks for being part of the change we want to see in the world. We can do this at scale to keep things in balance, as we talked about with Mark. Till next time, hoo-yah, divine out.